From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and this morning Mary Beth Maziarz and I speak with veteran educator Dr. Mort Sherman, along with his daughter, educator and musician Sarah Sherman, about their upcoming new book, Resonant Minds, The Transformative Power of Music, One Note at a Time, and about how we should be taking a more mindful approach to how we use music in our lives. This conversation, of course, made more interesting by my co-host, Mary Beth Maziarz, who makes a living as a musician. So stay tuned for that. Then in the second half, we will hear from local business owners Caden Otley and Philippe Mosquese about the mental and physical benefits of something called contrast therapy. Contrast as in hot, cold, hot, cold. It's something you can now experience for yourself in the saunas and the cold plunge facilities of their newly opened spa at Kimmel Junction. It's called Avanto, and they're ready to give you the hot, cold contrast therapy experience. We'll be right back after these words from our underwriters. Stay with us. You're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City.
Welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Most of us enjoy music, even without considering that it profoundly shapes our cognitive, emotional, and social experiences. But did you know that when paired with mindful action, it can actually help us experience more joy, think more creatively, and tap into something bigger than ourselves? This morning, we're speaking with visionary educator Dr. Mort Sherman and Sarah Sherman, a pioneer in establishing innovative approaches that use music as a tool for mindful learning and personal growth. The Shermans have written a new book called Resonant Minds, The Transformative Power of Music, One Note at a Time, which is sure to help more of us appreciate all the ways that music of all kinds impacts our lives all the time. Dr. Mort Sherman, Sarah Sherman, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Good morning.
You're welcome. Well, let's start a little bit. Tell us what brought you two to write this book and what was it like to write it together?
All right, why don't you start?
All right. So as a child, I was always exposed to music. It was an integral part of our household. I would fall asleep to classical music. My sister was taking piano lessons, and I would sneak into the room and play all the songs she played after her lessons. One of my first memories of taking music and really making it a part of myself and ourselves was with my dad with Ode to Joy. And we sang animal sounds and made up our own words to it, ignoring the German, just screaming it at the top of our lungs on repeat. And it was such a formative moment to be like, hey, this is serious music, but it doesn't have to be serious. Then we fast forward, and I'm a classically trained pianist at this point in my life. And it's always been a goal to find that way to make music joyful and an interactive experience. When my daughter was 4 months old, I was still performing regularly, and I brought her to a big concert I was playing. I was soloist with orchestra, and she was the only baby in the audience. And I was like, oh, this is great that she's here, but where are all the other kids? And there was a gap in New York City in particular for that really young age group, 0 to 3 year olds, where they could be exposed to professional musicians, live music, and kids could be kids. So Mozart for Munchkins was born in 2017, and my father and my mother were huge sounding boards. I'd say, well, can I do this? What do you think about this? What do you think about that? And the very first concert they came up to, and my dad held my daughter as I played Flight of the Bumblebee, and she buzzed around like a bumblebee in the air with him. And I played Rhapsody in Blue, and the people would clap along to it. And since then, it's really grown into all ages and always having that interactive element. Over the last 2 or 3 years, we've worked with Mind Up, the Goldie Hawn Foundation, on merging music and mindful action. And all of those professional development days I did with teachers at the UFT, the United Federation of Teachers, or going into schools in New York City, I'd always call my dad and say, hey, what do you think about this idea? What do you think about that idea? And he was always my sounding board. And he would say, you're writing your book. You're writing your book. And I said, I'm not doing this without you. And so I think we've been writing the book together for years. And in the last few years where we really put the pen down to paper, it's been a joy to collaborate, to throw ideas back and forth, and to see the work that we've done together and really that formed my whole upbringing come to life.
Oh, that's wonderful. Isn't it amazing when just the organic process happens that way? You just find that your life has created the structure for this book?
But, you know, it's interesting as a parent and as an admirer of Sarah and a lover of music. I grew up in a household. My father was a Depression guy. He never graduated from high school. I don't think he could tell you Rachmaninoff from a brake shoe on a car when he fixed it. But somehow, when we used to drive into New York to visit his in-laws, my grandpa's, we used to sing from the halls of Montezuma at the top of our lungs with my dad, because he was a Marine. And there's just something that I call that mindful spark that occurred, and I never really understood it. I didn't love classical music. I watched Leonard Bernstein on television, you know, the children's concerts and all that, which preceded him and followed him. There's always this moment in the back of my head about music, whether I was listening to Mamas and the Papas when I was in the 60s with my mom and singing, good, you know, Monday, Monday, whatever it was, there's always that connection that I had. And so as Sarah taught us, she became this remarkable teacher of parents and of our family about music. And so this reciprocal nature that we've had as parents with her, we want to create with others. And it's just not about classical music, because in some way it's such an iconoclastic approach. It's so narrow that we want to figure out how to connect others and to respect others and to learn from others. And that mindful spark, whatever it is, has intrigued me all my life as an educator. It's not just when I was an English teacher or a principal or a superintendent, but as a parent. You know, at one piece, I read Amy Tan's Joy Luck Club years ago. And there's that moment where Amy Tan talks about being this really accomplished chess player, and where her mom pushed her so hard, she knocked Amy Tan knocked a chessboard off. I don't know if you remember that scene. And so when Debbie, my wife, and I raised Sarah, we were always aware. How hard do we push this child? How what do we do? Go practice, Sarah. Go do this. But what we wanted to do is instill for her and for her sisters and for our grandchildren a love of the world around them. And I think ultimately that's the question we come to in this book. How do we use music as that lever for respecting and caring for each other, and not, well, Sarah could talk about this better than I, but falling into the algorithm of the familiar.
So true. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Sarah and Mort Sherman, father and daughter, and they're authors of a new book called Resonant Minds, The Transformative Power of Music, One Note at a Time. It's funny that you say one note, or in the byline, one note at a time. And I can think of songs that affect me on some deep emotional level, just like three or four notes put together. And I, unlike Mary Beth and unlike the two of you, am not a musician at all. I'm just one of those people who, you know, for whom music kind of penetrates the soul in some way, but it's so personal. How do we figure out, you know, for ourselves, what is going to be the music that moves us? Sarah, maybe you could take that.
Such a great question. And I love that you say, you know, you're not the same musical as Mary Beth or either of us. And I think everyone has their inner musician, and it's how we engage our inner musician. And part of that is approaching ourselves in a non-judgmental way. And so when we think about what music can help find that grounding presence, it's finding what really resonates with you. Again, it's not always about classical music, where for me it might be Bach cello suites, but maybe another day it's something obscure like Sigur Rós, or I need to just sing at the top of my lungs and I'm going to play Shake It Off by Taylor Swift. And I don't think it has to be one size fits all. And it's really about finding like that one note at a time, one song at a time that maybe you can come back to time and time again and create a positive habit. When I play this song, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to take a deep breath and feel my feet on the ground underneath me. And it, when you do that enough times with a certain piece of music, you're having that behavior from your implicit memory going to your implicit memory. So it becomes routine. It becomes something that is this automatic response in our system. Like we do, you know, you teach kids about Pavlov, and it's a very similar way in which we can use music to create these positive habits and favorite songs for ourselves.
I just want to spend a minute about that because it's such a core question to the work we're doing, is trying to figure out how to give people what Sarah calls a silence between the notes, how to give that pause, how to give that moment where we can think deeply about your question about how, in fact, we move ahead. And my wife, who was our critical reader, we used to say, like, we're thinking of this, we got all excited. And she would go, okay, kids, including me, calm down. And how do you motivate? How do you move? Like, it's a great theory, but how do you motivate people? And I think what you're asking is that piece. And so whether it's that skier on top of a slope on top of Park City, there is that moment where you pause. I'm thinking of Michael Phelps. He had the earbuds and he was silently sitting and listening to his music. How do we help folks have that moment, that breath, where they could think about what they're going to do next, how they're going to go about it? So that's that mindful action, one note at a time. We're not saying everybody all of a sudden sing like Taylor Swift or play Rachmaninoff or a Bach cello concerto. We're saying figure out that note, but take that breath. You know, Dan Pink talks about it in Drive. He talks about intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. That's so core. And that's where we brought in Ellen Galinsky with her work on executive functioning. We brought in Bennett Kallik, Habits of Mind and Habits of Life. We think that's core to what you're asking, Lynn.
Yeah. I can't ever have one of these conversations about music without, and I'll bring up this now dated Sundance Film Festival movie, since we were talking about the film festival before we went on air. And it's called Alive Inside. I think it was from about 2014, to 10 years ago. But it's about how it was a documentary. They went into memory care where the patients, you know, by and large, all had Alzheimer's, and how they could figure out what their music was from the time in their life where music was really important to them. And they could all sing along, even if they were no longer verbal. And I've just always been so fascinated by the way that our brain captures music in a way that it doesn't let it go, even though it may let go of our very words that we use to speak with. And so could you talk a little bit about really what physiologically, what goes on in the brain when we hear music?
Sarah's got to take that because we've talked about Oliver Sacks in the book. We have some quotes from him, and I'm not sure if that's what you were talking about, but his work is really seminal to this. Sarah, this is your question.
All right. And I'm going to preface by saying this. I'm a pianist first and not a neuroscientist, but it's a really fascinating question. And I'm going to go back to those memory, that implicit and explicit memory that I mentioned before. And part of it is about creating these memory attachments. If I throw out a song to you right now, I'm going to try that in for whoever's listening and see what comes to your mind right away. If I say Jingle Bells, can you think of the last time that you heard it or that you sang it? Or You Are My Sunshine. Maybe it's Jaws, which is now also done with Baby Shark all the time. And hearing a song can trigger in a memory and association. It could also be a smell. It could be baking cookies on Christmas and that you think of Jingle Bells or whatever that attachment is. When you hear a song time and time again in our brain, it releases these, our neural synapses go off and you create these attachments to it. And it becomes this automatic response after a while when we listen to music. And I think what happens, and again, I'm not a neuroscientist, it's like when you have an earworm, it's called your phonological loop. And so it gets stuck and it goes on and over and over and again. And it's this hook, but it does attach to your memory so that when an Alzheimer's patient starts to lose their memory. That song has been associated with something time and time again throughout their lifetime, that it's not lost, where maybe a name is lost or a memory is lost. But if they have that song that is triggering that memory, it brings them back. And I think that's a lot of beautiful therapies are going on right now for Alzheimer's patients, for patients with dementia, that can bring back these memories that feel lost until the song that is attached to them come back to. And there's a lot of research on all of those theories coming back time and time again to help patients bring back memories.
Isn't that fascinating? Phonological loop. I never knew that that was the scientific name for an earworm. I love that.
For your little earworms. Yes.
I love it.
There's another neuroscience term that I didn't know existed before Sarah taught it to me. Groove. Do you know that's a real neuroscientific term?
I did not.
Well, that's another we could talk about if you'd like. Wow. But that's part of what Lynn was just asking. Get in the groove.
Yeah, exactly. Sarah, it's an actual thing. Well, these days, so I've got two boys and they listen to music all the time. It's a huge part of their lives. And one thing that's been amazing is how wide their musical knowledge is. Far, far wider than ours was when I was a teenager. I think it's the availability of so many songs online. They can basically access any song at any time. And that democratization of music availability is really a wonderful thing. How can we harness that for this up-and-coming generation to help make sure they're listening to as wide a group of songs as they could?
Yeah, no, I would bet as a parent, something's going on in your household that expands their repertoire, their listening, because most people are the opposite. Most people fall into that phonological loop, fall into, in fact, what we're calling the playlist of the familiar. So commercially, you turn on, I'm not going to name all the commercial products out there. You go to say my playlist, and it's the same song, and then another song, and you start hitting skip because you get tired of it, and you never figure out, well, maybe I should listen to broader music tastes and different genres of music. And so technology is actually drawing us into this very familiar algorithm that we want to break through. And so whatever you're doing in the household at your place, Mary Beth, we want to capture that and drink of the waters to help others. But part of what we're writing is exactly that point, is how do you in fact create networks if you don't know music? And I'll speak as an educator just real quickly about this, and then Sarah could speak as a parent and a musician. I was a superintendent, I was a principal, I was a teacher, and I always worried about how we became narrow. For example, did you ever listen to Marian Anderson in 1939, her music, her speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial when she was denied access to Constitution Hall by the Daughters of the American Revolution? Did you have that part of your social studies? Or did you know that Amazing Grace was used by George Washington and every president since? Can you imagine the music which would have touched it in the way that Lynn and Sarah were talking before, in fact, that would have connected us in a deep, visceral way. Yet in education, hey, read pages 15 to 20 when you go home today and we'll talk about it tomorrow, rather than connecting deeply, or that Shakespeare is full of music, or you could list example after example of how we as educators could bring it into the classroom to connect better than we have in the past. And so what you've done at home, Sarah could talk about, I could talk about the opportunities that go beyond what we've done in schools, because we have fallen into that algorithm of the familiar and textbook-based rather than expanding opportunities through pedagogy.
Well, I will say that I've been a musician for years, so we have many instruments around the house. The kids have heard practicing and rehearsing for gigs and things, so there could be something a little bit unique about our household. But I do think it's amazing how, if they do want to look, if they are open to new kinds of music, how wonderful it is to do it. But so many schools are cutting music programs. And for me, those are critical classes, the art, the theater, the music. So what can we do to encourage our schools to find ways to insert music into their daily work?
Mary Beth, I do want to ask one question. Are your children on any type of social media or TikTok or any of those type of things? Yeah,
they are actually, and they find a lot of music on there. So I know it's a double-edged sword, but they do learn a lot. They use the internet as a tool to learn new instruments all the time. They won't let me teach them anything.
My kids are similar. But I was going to ask, because on average, American listens to music 3 hours a day. And when you think about that number, that's a lot of hours of the day. But when you think about the way music is utilized, even on something like Instagram or TikTok or whatever it is these days, their reels have some type of music. So we're listening to music, whether we're really actively or passive listening is something else, but we're constantly hearing music. So that's just my little side note. I think there's something about that generation that's being exposed to music in a way that we weren't. We didn't have an Instagram reel playing a hit tune that maybe we wouldn't have heard about until we saw somebody dance to it 1,000 times, you know, the way that these viral dances go on now. But in terms of schools, I'll cycle back that way. I think music programs being cut are really tragic, as we all know that music has benefits for focus, for community building, for leadership, for social emotional literacy in the classroom, for people to connect. I think teachers can utilize music in the classroom, whether it's through curriculum and something like teaching about Kennedy and the way he used music when he brought, we talked about Mary Anderson earlier, and he brought her during the civil rights movement to play music in the White House for the first time, or the way Lincoln used music and played Dixie, or the way he used his marching drum during the Civil War. And so there are so many ways which we can use music as a part of curriculum that have these integrative ways of teaching students. And we know the more ways that our brains attach to history and music and art, the more we're likely to retain information. Beyond that, there are ways, like I was saying, with these associations that we can do for even younger kids. Hey, we're going to pick a song in the beginning of the school year. And let's say it is Katy Perry, Fireworks. And whenever we hear that song, it means it's time to line up and go out for recess. Or let's say it's going to be Mozart and it's time to sit down and have our quiet reading time. And if a teacher uses music repetitively in this fashion in the classroom, the children get these associations with it to know what to do. And so it brings music into the classroom in a way that's not invasive, but it's complementary to the way that the teacher is already interacting with their students on a daily basis.
Wait, just anthropologically, not that I'm answering. Yeah, but this question about why they're cutting music, maybe it's not seen as important because of the way we've taught it over the years. Maybe, you know, when I was a kid in the 50s and 60s, we were told to sit a certain way and to listen to a certain kind of music, and it never became a visceral part of my soul. Yeah. And so what Sarah's saying, I think, is the way to get it back into schools.
One thing about that, I don't know if you're familiar with the Zander's book of Art of Possibility.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
I love that work. It's such a great book. But he talks about how the shift from, you know, someone who's just a rote player to someone who's passionate is the butt on the seat. When the butt starts lifting off the seat, that shows their excitement. And I just love it.
The one buttock playing, that's what he...
And if you haven't seen his video, it's Shining Eyes, the art of, that goes with the Art of Possibility. It's amazing. I'm sorry, Lynn. We get excited about our work.
We do too.
Yeah, it's great. Your excitement is really infectious. And we're out of time, but I just wanted to ask you another question about how we as parents can connect to the music that our children love. I think it's a really important thing. I was at a Super Bowl party and there were all kinds of ages, and on comes the halftime show. And most of the adults I noticed were saying, "Who is this?" You know, they didn't recognize automatically that it was Kendrick Lamar, myself included. But I looked around at the 12-year-olds in the room, the 13-year-olds. They were mouthing every single word along with it. And even though my kids are grown now and they're on their own, I feel like that could be a really valuable way for parents to connect to kids, is to know their music. Can you give us a few suggestions?
Yeah, I think it's something even as simply, granted, I'm biased towards my children and they've grown up with this musical lifestyle. But what we often do as a family is we take turns. Everyone gets to pick one song. And my son especially is like, "No, I don't want to hear this one again." But he also has expressed the same, "Well, if you don't like it, you have to listen to it once. And maybe you have to listen to it twice. And then a third time. And if you still don't like it, that's okay, but you gave it a chance." And so I think in expanding our musical horizons, you know, my 4-year-old son at that time, Now he's older, but he really explained it beautifully that we have to give it a chance. And listening to our children's music, our friends' music, the music that's going on to our in throughout our community is really important, even if it doesn't resonate with us, because it's a way of connecting and potentially understanding someone in a way we might not have otherwise.
I'm so sorry that we're out of time. I feel like we could talk about this for hours, and you are both so interesting. We are talking with Sarah and Mort Sherman, authors of a new book called Resonant Minds, The Transformative Power of Music, One Note at a Time. And of course, I love this book, but I think whether you're a musician, whether you're just an aficionado, whether you just are interested in becoming more involved with music, this is a great book, and it is fascinating in education and in parenting and in just your personal experience and mindfulness for yourself. So thank you so much both for joining us on the program today.
Thank you.
Thanks
for having us.
Welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
From the Romans to the Finnish to the Turkish to the Norwegian, for millennia, cultures all over the world have appreciated the traditions of hot baths and saunas, as well as bracingly cold dips or rolls in the snow. And as anyone who's ever enjoyed a deep Japanese ofuro bath or been part of a polar plunge or ice bucket challenge knows, swift changes in our core temperatures can have a big effect on our physiology, as well as our mental outlook. Our next guests are Caden Otley and Philippe Musquez, did I say that right?
Yep. Okay. Yep.
co-owners of a new facility in Park City called Avanto Park City that highlights the benefits of contrast therapy and makes it available to locals and visitors here in Park City. Caden and Philippe, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks so much. So much for
You're
having
welcome.
Us.
Well, let's jump right in. I think that most of us are familiar with things like saunas and cold plunge therapy, but I hadn't heard the term contrast therapy before. Can you share with our listeners what exactly contrast therapy is and how it benefits us?
Sure, yeah. So contrast therapy really is just, you know, hot, cold therapy. It's just kind of describing it in the realm of the contrast between the hot and the cold. So I think it's just like a more efficient name for it.
Sure. And is it something people do primarily for just physiological reasons? Like what kind of benefits does one get from contrast therapy?
Yeah. So there are a lot of physiological benefits. One of the more well-known ones is that, you know, if you sauna four times a week, especially in a traditional dry sauna, your all-cause mortality, or you have a reduction in all-cause mortality by like 40%, which is amazing. Obviously beyond that, there's, you know, major inflammation reduction, especially when you're doing the cold plunge with the sauna. And, you know, inflammatory disease is so prominent these days that this is a great way to kind of combat it, and it's very needed. There's a study that I'm thinking of where they actually talk about a 250% increase in dopamine after a cold plunge. And anybody who's listening who's tried one can attest to it. It's super addicting. It's super fun once you get past how scary it is.
Well, yeah, I'm personally a little scared of the cold plunge, but whenever I have done it, it is the most exhilarating feeling. And I get what you're saying about the dopamine rush or whatever it is, that it just seems to work and you feel that tingle. It's very alluring. So set us up for what Avanto is like. Where are you located and how is how is it set up inside? Philippe, you want to go take that?
Yes, for sure. We are located in Kimball Junction, right by the state liquor store. That's pretty easy for people to know where they are. That's what we have found out. Then our space, the flow of our space, it's meant to go from hot then to a rinse station when people can just rinse off all of those chemicals that our bodies are getting out of, from rid of, if I may say it that way. And then we go into a cold plunge. We have two different cold plunges. One is set at 50 degrees. The other one is set as 40. We could get one of them down to 32 if we want it and make ice with it. but we're not doing that.
And just for special groups. Yeah.
So yeah, and after that, we have a hydration station. That's when people can stay there for a few minutes, allow their bodies to recover temperature by themselves, which helps with
It's basically when you're allowing your core temperature to come up naturally, that's where you're getting most of like the cardiovascular and respiratory benefits that cold plunge and sauna offers. It's also, you know, one of the most uncomfortable parts because your body's telling you, hey, I want to go jump back in the sauna. But we try to encourage people like, hey, drink some tea, do some movements that will help you kind of recuperate and then go back after you've warmed up naturally.
Okay. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with co-owners of Avanto, a new cold plunge along with sauna, cold hot contrast therapy place in Kimball Junction. We're speaking with Caden Otley and Philippe Mosquez, and they, along with another co-owner, Josh Stewart, have just opened this place. So they're joining us to tell us about the benefits of contrast therapy. So again, you've got these cold plunge stations, but then you also have one sauna or several saunas. What do these saunas look like there?
Yeah, so we have one big sauna, and it is a traditional dry sauna. We control the humidity. We have an employee that will come in about every 15 minutes and pour water over the rocks to kind of introduce steam and make it easier to breathe. Our sauna is big enough that it, you know, we could have 12 people in there if we wanted. But we cap our groups at 6, unless it's a special event and somebody's renting out the space.
Nice. Yeah, it seems like the communal aspect of saunas, at least, has always been part of many, many cultures. So it's nice that you could be in there with a few other folks, but not feel overwhelmed by a really large group.
Yeah, so that's exactly what we were going for when we designed the space. Is we, Philippe and I both have had a ton of networking opportunities in saunas. And even just, we have a group called the Weekly Reset, where we go to the Prova River and just go cold plunge with a bunch of people. And how many people do we have in that group now?
Probably 50 or more.
Yeah, probably 50 or more people.
Wow.
And yeah, it's super, super fun. But the networking opportunities and just the communal aspect is really important to us. So
that's so interesting, the networking opportunities. What is it about being in the sauna? Is it the vulnerability, or what do you think it is that makes it so conducive to connecting on a different level?
We have found out that the sauna brings people like-minded, people that are trying to focus on their own health, trying to improve in any kind of way possible. And the sauna is just one of those ways, right? So that brings a really special kind of people. And that's what we're trying to focus on. We want to build this community where people can come and find in Avanto an opportunity to go and tackle whatever they need on their lives. Despite what it is, we all have different challenges and different focuses. And that's what we want.
Yeah, it definitely is somewhat vulnerable, you know, as well. So we definitely feel like the vulnerability is, you know, plays a role in that. You know, you get in there and you're sweating and even in a cold plunge, it's super uncomfortable, and being uncomfortable with other people, you just bond with them really easily and you make friends like no other way.
Okay, so saunas and cold plunge pools take different shapes all over the world. I'm assuming this is one, is it co-ed, and does everyone wear all of their attire, as in bathing suits, or, you know, many of them don't allow any clothes at all, including bathing suits?
Yeah, so we do require clothing in our sauna, you know, we and in our space, you know, obviously just we're not European, and so we have to kind of abide by those social norms, and also I think, you know, most people just feel more comfortable in a bathing suit. So yeah, that is our space is included in that.
How many times do you go from cold to hot in a session? Or what does a session look like in terms of, like, am I paying one price and I come in and I have 3 hours to stay? Or how do, what does that all look like?
So we have 1 hour sessions where we can have up to six people, unless we rent the space out, and then that's a different thing. But the way it works, I don't know if you guys have heard of Andrew Huberman. He's done a lot of research. He's a neuroscientist. And we suggest people 12 to 15 minutes in the sauna, then rinse, go to a cold plunge between 2 and 6 minutes, and then rest outside of the cold plunge for about 8 minutes. Then you repeat that cycle again.
And most of the time, so we offer hour sessions. Most of the time, our guests can make it through the entire space, you know, do that cycle twice in an hour. If they're quicker, if their protocol is quicker, then, you know, maybe more. And that's just very specific to each individual.
It's also what we recommend, but that doesn't mean that people need to do that. When they book the session, the space is theirs.
Nice. Well, my husband is a huge fan of the cold plunge. We have an outdoor kind of stock tank thing. And after he comes back from a mountain bike ride, that's his very favorite thing to do, is go in there. And it's so cold. And he comes out just exhilarated. Now, I am a hot person. I can sit in a scalding hot bath and I just love it. I find it deeply relaxing. But the cold part freaks me out. How could I psychologically trick myself into doing this? Because I really want to, but I just feel a little bit, it just is a little hard for me to wrap myself around.
Yeah, totally. It totally makes sense.
It is not easy for anyone. When we started going to Pearl River, our hands would freeze, our feet would freeze. So we have found out through research that breathing techniques are really important. Okay. So we tell people that the first 45 seconds of getting into a cold plunge is where you get into your fight or flight response and you just want to get out of there. So if you can slow down your breathing during those first 45 seconds, then it gets easier, right? And it's just also a point of relaxing. I know that it sounds like the opposite, but when we tense up in cold water, it's harder. So if we just like let it in, then we shouldn't fight.
Another thing to consider too is like, so, you know, I totally get being a hot person, you know, it's like, okay, I like the sauna feels so good and the cold plunge, you know, in the beginning just does not. But when you get in a sauna, especially ours, you know, it's 200 degrees and you're in there for 15 minutes, your body is like begging for that cold plunge. And so it's like, exactly, that's the key, is get hot enough, sweat and get really uncomfortable, and that's what this is all about. Just get uncomfortable.
Yeah, so I just got to get hot enough. I suppose there's a pretty big empowerment piece in it. I have a friend in New York who takes an ice cold shower in the morning and an outdoor shower, and she says that once she's done that, she feels like she can do anything, because it is hard going into it, but then there is a feeling. Do you find that that's a common reaction, or do people have all kinds of reactions?
You're 100% right. It's like, it's very empowering. So this past month, we've just been taking friends and family through. We've probably had about 200 people through the space over the last like 2 weeks. And every single one, especially those who have never done it before, tell us after the session, and you can see it in their eyes. You know, they're just like, I feel so alive. Like, I feel like I can do anything. Like, I stayed in that 40 degree cold plunge for, you know, 5 minutes and I didn't think I could do it. And it's a pretty like gratifying experience for us.
It must be so different from like the way at a traditional spa where people come out of a massage and they're just like all loopy and vague. Like, I bet people come out of here and they're just like alert and ready to roll and feeling good. Yeah. That's interesting.
You're 100% right. And see, and that's another reason this communal thing works so well, is because everybody's amped, you know, everybody's in that extroverted part of themselves once they start doing this, because you just can't help it. You're ready to connect with people. You're ready to go take on your life.
Okay, so we have done other interviews on this show about sitting in a cold dunk or, you know, the polar plunge. And I can't remember exactly how it goes, but physiologically, they say if you stay in a longer period of time, that effect, that the dopamine effect, it stays with you longer than any other instance in which you might be experiencing dopamine. And I can't remember how long it is, but when I go into a cold plunge, I'm like the 5-second gal. But they're talking of, you know, after you've been in for 2 minutes, it gets easier. So explain this, take us through this, either one of you.
You are 100% right. There are two different kinds of stress. There is a good stress and it's a bad stress. Good stress helps you go through life and conquer anything that you want. It's not easy, but it helps you. Then you have the bad stress, which is a aging stress. It ages ourselves. So on cold plunges, and it also depends on body composition and how cold the water is, but on freezing water, we suggest people to stay at least 2 minutes if they can. That's where they get all of the benefits. But then no more than 6 minutes. Because going over those 6-7 minutes, that's where your cells start to age and that stress passes from being good to not good for you. So anything, even if it's good, that we do way too much, it's not good for us. But you're totally right on that glow that we get after the cold plunge. If we get out of the cold plunge, this is the, we're talking about this, it's kind of like a funny thing.
Yes. Well, it's yeah.
So people compare cold plunges with cocaine, for example. I've never had an experience with it.
Yeah, we can't attest.
But they said that cocaine basically makes people feel like a superhero for 40 minutes. But then cold plunges give you that glow for the next 8 hours, and it's natural. It doesn't mess up with your body. So it's a great way to go on your day and just take on everything you need.
Okay. So Philippe, a little bit ago, you mentioned someone's name, and I did get it, but I always ask people in this case about the Wim Hof method. You mentioned someone else.
Yeah.
What was the name of this person who's done a lot of research?
It's Andrew Huberman.
Oh yeah. Huberman. Okay. Yeah,
so he's a neuroscientist from Stanford.
Okay. Right. Okay. Yes. We know of his work very well, but I just didn't hear when you said.
They just had a hard time understanding your accent.
No.
Yeah, I apologize for that.
No, it's a great accent.
You'll learn in English.
No. Okay, so I have a question. When I do this sort of thing, and I actually just recently have been lucky enough to be on vacation and
nice
in a place where they do this sort of thing a lot. It's a way of life. It's a culture. It's, you know, hot saunas and cold plunges. And I often wonder, for those who don't have a really strong constitution, like maybe they have some kind of, I don't know, like heart disease, or what about those people who may have diabetes or things like that? Are there any instances in which the contrast is contraindicated?
Yes, there are definitely contraindications. And we have a waiver that anybody who participates in our space has to sign. And in that waiver, it just kind of recommends that you talk to your doctor. And you know, that's a very personal decision in our opinion. Obviously, any kind of advanced cardiovascular issues puts you at higher risk of something happening, because you're putting your body under stress, right? In the sauna, it's comparable to a zone 2 cardio workout. And so if you're not able to do that, then that might be something that you stay away from, or you know, talk to your doctor at the very least. But it's funny that you bring it up because I actually have SVT, supraventricular tachycardia, which is an electrical dysfunction in my heart. And I've had ablations done. I had them done when I was 14 and it ended up coming back around 2019. So it's basically exercise induced. My heart will jump to, 200 beats per minute and won't stop. So it'll just like, I could stop exercising. I can breathe through it. It'll stay at 200 beats per minute for an hour, And so I've had to be cardioverted 3 different times. They'll inject adenosine, just a hormone into my veins, and it'll just stop my heart and reset it. And so this is my way of saying that, I've worked through it in other ways. Like I've really worked on my getting to know my body. And I know my limits and I know what I can handle and what I can't. And if I, I ease into things like this, and I think that other people can as well, as long as they're just very conscious of what their limits are.
Perfect. Well, how can people find you and book a session?
Yeah. So they can find us at avantoparkcity.com. And they can also call us, and our information is all on our website. So feel free to call, text, email us. And on our website, you can just book an appointment. We also offer memberships. And so if that is of interest, save some money.
Well, Caden Otley and Philippe Musquez, this has been really inspiring. My husband's been bugging me to do this for about 2 years now, and I think you may have nudged me over the top. I think I'm willing to give it a try. So come visit Avanto Park City if this also appeals to you, and we thank you so much for being on The Mountain Life this morning.
Yeah, thank you guys. Well, and really quick, you guys should bring a group in. Bring some friends.
I think maybe we will.
I think okay. We might. Yeah.
We'd love to see you. So.
Yeah. Well, then we can be personal proselytizers about it.
That sounds great.
Yeah. One final question. Do you have a website?
Yeah. AvantoParkCity.com.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. Hey, okay. We'll reiterate,
Missed that.
Yes. And it's not just Avanto.com, because that is some other random Avanto, and it's not in Park City, and it's not a site that is up. So don't go there. Avanto Park.
Yeah, that's right. We have Avanto Spa and AvantoParkCity.com, but AvantoParkCity.com is our main website. So
perfect. Great. Well, good luck. I hope the opening goes well and that lots of people come and find you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And again, that was Avanto Spa, and we've just been sitting here talking about it at the radio station, what we think about the contrast therapy and the relative benefits. And as always, these things, these alternative type, well, it's not even alternative, but other therapies that sometimes make great claims, so much of it really is anecdotal, and the people who love it, love it. There's such a huge sauna spa culture around the world, and people swear by it. So speaking of health and sleep, let's talk about sleep this week, everyone. How does everyone feel after the beginning of daylight savings time? So we're 3 days into it, and I don't know about your workplace, but at my workplace, it's everyone talks about how hard it is. And especially this year, it's harder than other years, which, again, it's anecdotal. There's no evidence for that. But a few things about daylight savings time is that there has been so much legislation in different countries, in different states over the years to get rid of daylight savings time, to just have one standard time throughout the entire year. And most of this legislation has passed, but it has never actually gone into effect that daylight savings time has been dropped, and we continue to do it. So that's curious. The other thing, of course, and this may make sense to you, is that the spring forward, the daylight savings time beginning, is always harder on the body than in the fall because, of course, we're giving up another hour of sleep. But also, it's because of that morning light exposure. Springing forward means you're getting less morning light, which can more readily negatively impact your mood and even your hormone levels and disrupt your circadian rhythm, which leads to a messed up internal clock, fatigue, difficulty concentrating, and even, and this is proven, potential increases in heart attacks and strokes and other health issues just by that 1 hour. It's kind of fascinating. Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life this morning here on KPCW Park City.